The Farmers' Journal this week has a pull-out report that gives as good an overview as you're going to get anywhere on the pros and cons of producing food on this island in the years ahead. It's written by a number of people, but the guiding hand was that of Lorcan Roach Kelly, who joins me in studio. Good morning to you, Lorcan.
Good morning.
You also, by coincidence, have a front-page story this week in the Farmers' Journal under the headline "Profits at Fertiliser Companies Soar" that I want to start with. February 2022 was when war in Ukraine started, when chemical fertilizer prices started to soar. You've been doing a little bit of number crunching around the profits that these companies made. How much did they make?
Well, I think like everyone knows in farming circles, certainly, that the price of fertilizer went through the roof in 2022. And we were just kind of look back at some of the companies. There are five or six big suppliers in Ireland, and they report their accounts kind of with a year lag. So we only kind of get a look at 2022 numbers now. We look through them, and the profits are up around 160%. Across the board from what we said. Just taking like an average of the companies. Mm-hmm.
And how much is that in pounds, shilling and pence?
It's about 35, 40 million euros of extra profit from just looking at the numbers.
And the interesting thing is that at this point in time, or as a consequence of this, fertiliser usage dropped.
Fertiliser usage dropped in 2022 and has dropped again in 2023. Actually, the catalyst for writing this piece was we got CSO data on fertiliser use in 2023, and I just looked at the numbers, and we are down 33% from 2021 to 2023, which is a huge drop. But incidentally, the price of fertiliser in 2023 was still 50% higher than 21. So the revenues in 2023 are equal to the revenue of 2021. It's just that 2022 was such a huge year for the fertiliser companies.
So these companies made their margin not on each ton that was sold, but on a percentage of the price at which it was sold.
Exactly. So they were buying, say they were buying at 100 euros a ton, they were selling at 110 euros a ton in 2021. Price doubled to 200 euros a ton, and they were then putting their 10% margin again. So they were selling at 220 a ton, meaning they were making 20 euros profit, where they were making 10 before. And that's
back of an envelope kind of maths, though. Those sort of profits means that if every single farm in the country was using the same amount of fertiliser, which they're not, you'd be talking about each farm having given 200 euro or thereabouts.
Yeah, absolutely. This profit, the extra profit the companies made, was paid for by the farmer.
The interesting thing, though, is that farm after farm that I have been to in the course of the last year and a half talk about how much less fertiliser they're using and how they probably won't go back to using as much. So have they killed the goose that laid the golden egg?
I think this is very much, like we were discussing this the other day. If you look at the best thing the fertiliser companies could get right now is a real big drop in fertiliser, because they need to get their demand back. They need their customers to come back and say, yes, we want to start spreading more fertiliser. Because if farmers have dropped usage by a third in 2 years, if that sticks, then the size of the market these companies are in is just going to get smaller and smaller as people find out, actually, we don't need all this fertiliser we were spreading, or we need slightly less fertiliser, or we can do with less. Okay. So I think they've killed their own golden goose, I think, in some way, that you're saying.
You have set yourself, with this supplement that is published this week, the no less a task of assessing nothing smaller than the entire future of food production. There are challenges and there are opportunities out there, but I think what's interesting is how completely different the landscape is to when you did the same exercise just 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think like last time we looked at kind of the outlook for farming, we were very much in the almost a crisis, not say a crisis, but there was so much change at the time. We had, like as you said, the price of fertilizer, the price of feed, the price of fuel all went through the roof. The three F's, we called them at the time, was the big problem. I think now things have settled down a little bit on price side. Like, things aren't great, they never are for farming, but settled down a little bit. The weather's been a challenge for everybody. But we kind of took a step back and kind of looked more, I suppose, strategically on where the industry is, what the challenges are and what the opportunities are.
Until recently, farmers might have felt that climate change was about regulation changes from Brussels. Now, though, I mean, you're putting your finger on this, it is as much about adapting to rule changes and the reality of climate change.
Yeah, I think you're slightly unfair saying farmers thought climate change was just about rule changes. Farmers were aware of what was happening around them as well. But I think if we look at the report, we kind of figured this time we're the three Fs last time, we're the three Es now. The first one is the economy. Environment. And environment comes both regulation and climate changing. So there are two challenges that run hand in hand. And for farmers, it's very understanding to say we don't like the regulation because we're already dealing with the problems. So if you're under pressure with, say, 10 months of rain, and you're told, oh, by the way, you can't do X, Y, and Z anymore, it does feel a bit like piling on. But they are challenges have to be faced. We can't get away from either of them. The climate is changing. That has to be dealt with. And the regulation is coming. And that has to be dealt with. But it is trying to do these things in a way that is sustainable for the industry.
One of the other key challenges that you identify here, obviously, is, and this is a hardy perennial, the key pinch point to so much of food production is land. How profound is its impact?
Well, I think that if you look at land, everyone wants the same bit of land, I suppose, the big thing. But we're seeing right now, and this, I'm going to bring this up, the nitrates derogation is the big squeeze at the moment. We had an entire report last year on land, but the big squeeze is like dairy farmers have to make a choice if we lose the derogation, and hopefully we'll keep it. But if we lose derogation, we're going to lose a lot of cattle out of this country, or dairy farmers are going to have to need more land, and they're going to push out the tillage guys and push out the beef guys, and we kind of have a more, I suppose, monoculture with it. The other possibility with the derogation is that the farmers in Ireland will move slightly further away from the grass-based system we have. If you look at the difference between Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland milk production, in the Republic of Ireland, the difference between peak month in May and some of the smaller months is about five times. So we produce five times as much milk in 1 month as mm-hmm. we do in the lower months. Whereas in Northern Ireland, it's about 1.5 because they feel a lot more maize through cattle and a lot more production that way.
And your own paper had a very interesting little factoid just last week from the beef sector about how 25%, a full quarter of the animals that were slaughtered in the first quarter of this year had come from feedlots, essentially, and not from that grass-based... No, sorry, they obviously spent some time at grass.
Yes.
But not from primarily from the grass-based system, which is our unique selling point.
Yeah, I think like Ireland's got a PGI very recently, the Protected Geographic Indicator for Grass-Fed Irish Beef. And there is some element of feedlots in a lot of cattle, but it's the last kind of month or 6 weeks, or it could be only 3 or 4 days they've sent in a feedlot. But that's kind of, you look over the lifetime of an animal, generally they mm-hmm. spend so much time on grass because it's not economic to feed to a beef cattle.
But I thought the interesting thing was that just a few years ago it was 20%, now it's 25%. Yeah. So clearly there is a trend here that is moving away from a grass-based system.
I don't think the economics are there for the move away, too much away from a grass-based system. I think that the feedlot thing is just basically if you're a factory that's processing beef, it's easier to buy 1,000 cattle in one time than buy 10 cattle 100 times.
The nub of this, though, going back to the land issue, is that if you can't get access to more land, you're going to have to do less farming. So how much or how many farms do you think are going to become unviable?
Well, I think it's not even the farms becoming unviable. If we cover this in the report, one of the big problems we have is that where are we going to find the farmers? It's not so much the farms. Like, the succession is a huge issue in farming right now. The average age of farmers mm-hmm. is continuing to slowly rise. It's heading towards 60. And if we get past 60, like, it's farming is needs the youth, needs the vibrant people, needs people with ambition coming in. Not saying older people don't have ambition, but maybe they don't have the energy to try something new. Or maybe they're a bit slow about trying something new, a bit conservative. Whereas young people have the energy to do that. And we need to get those young people into farming. And we need to find better ways of getting them in and make farming an attractive lifestyle for them.
Another big picture issue here, which is quite surprising, is because we tend to characterise agriculture in this country as being two big eggs in the one basket, dairy and beef. But you pointed out in this report that dairy, for all of our talk about it, back in its peak year of 2022, actually only accounted for 40% of Irish exports.
Irish, yeah, 40%. I think like the Irish, one thing, the industry that also we never talk about, and it's very important, is the prepared consumer food sector. That's 20% of Irish food exports. And that's people making pies and breads and baked goods and ready-made meals and all these things. And this is, I suppose, we're looking for a bright future. That kind of sector is a huge growth sector right now in Ireland and internationally. And we produce some very good mm-hmm. goods within that sector. Like the Chagask and Borbia have done huge work to promote consumer foods, and as the markets are opening up around the world, we're in a very good place to take advantage okay. of that.
So is the trend there, Lorcan, that we're adding value at home rather than exporting the raw material?
It's been the trend for years, but it's really picked up recently because the price of the raw materials that even are produced in Ireland has gone up. Like the price of milk, the price to produce a litre of milk on a farm is 25% higher than it was 2 years ago. That has to be covered, and the profits have to be made along the system to keep it viable.
And these exports have achieved really remarkable global reach. Do you think, though, in the years ahead that we might have to sacrifice a little bit of that global reach in order to secure our own domestic food security?
I don't think so. I think, like, if you look at the challenges for the export market, the biggest challenge we face is actually on our doorstep at the moment, because the UK is signing trade deals with countries like Australia and New Zealand, and they're letting in, as part of those trade deals, there's huge amounts of agricultural products can now come to the UK from Australia and New Zealand. And the cost
But are they actually?
But it's interesting, they're not coming yet, but the cost of production is so low in Australia. It'll eventually come into stuff like food service. If you look at supermarkets, they like to have their supply chain short because it makes sense, so they'll continue to deal with Irish people. But if something like the food service industry might start to shift towards that, and it's all these things are all about margins. If you lose 5% of your biggest customer, then that's really going to leave a mark.
All of that regulation that we talked about earlier on is the constant bugbear of so many farmers. But do you think that it has a payoff, that it actually, to a certain extent, supports the claim that we are producing sustainable food?
I think we are producing, I know we are producing sustainable food, but I think what the farmers, I think, maybe need a little bit more. Because they have all these rules coming in, they maybe need to see the payoff a bit more. I think from the farmer's point of view, like, they're happy to do what's needed to be done to get things. But they'd like to say, okay, if I do X, I get Y. You know, and that's kind of, because nobody cares more about the environment, despite the reputation that some people might give them, than farmers, because they need a good environment to work in, because otherwise they won't be able to produce anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of unfair to look at farmers and say, oh, well, you're against regulation, you're against doing stuff for the environment to that. They're very much in favour of doing the right thing, but you have to bring them along as part of the conversation.
And with just a little bit less red tape and box
ticking. A little bit kind of talking down to them as well.
Lorcan Roach-Kelly, thank you very much for coming in to us this morning.